There was only two pieces of technology in North America that remain unchanged with European settlement. One is the canoe, and the second one is the snowshoe. No amount of European tinkering with either of those forms improved it at all.
That's Mark Neusel, co-author of the book Canoes, A Natural History in North America, released this fall by the University of Minnesota Press. I'm Jim Gallagher, and this is Paddle Minnesota on Northern Community Radio. Mark is a professor of journalism and communications at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul. Mark's co-author is Norman Sims, a retired professor at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. I caught up with Mark this week on the banks of the Mississippi to talk with him about his new book.
Well, this would seem to be a natural place for me to be talking about canoes and a canoe book in Grand Rapids and on the Mississippi River.
How did you and Norm come to the idea of writing this book?
We'd known each other slightly through professional acquaintances over the years, and we were ended up at a lunch in Boston, Massachusetts at one point with a third party who was a book editor who had worked with both of us on previous projects. And we spent the entire lunch talking about canoes and boating and just bored the book editor to tears. And she said at the end of it, "Hey, you guys ought to do something together on this," and the rest is history.
Clearly, you both have an interest in paddling and have that in your background. And how did that come together?
Norm and I both were from the Midwest originally. I'm from Iowa and he's from Central Illinois. And we both grew up on or near water, or what passed for water in Iowa and Central Illinois at the time, in boats. We had a long relationship with canoes in particular, mine since the late 1960s and his since the 1970s. We had both ended up building canoes, owning several canoes over the years. You know, you name the material, I've probably had a canoe in that material. Professional interest coincided with our hobby, I guess you could say, and it just worked out great. John McPhee, the great New Yorker writer, wrote the foreword for the book. Pulitzer Prize-winning guy, truly a scholar and a gentleman, and he has written so much on canoes and canoeing in his own life. And Norm had a relationship with John over the years, and John teaches still at Princeton University in New Jersey, and John agreed to do the foreword for the canoe book, and we just couldn't be prouder of that fact, that he's just one of the American icons in the writing world.
Well, it really caught my eye when I saw the book. You did a nice biography of him later in the book as well. Tell us a bit about what you've included in this book.
What we wanted to do was to describe the canoes in North America as best we could. And so we started out talking about dugouts and birch barks with the of course, the two main types of canoes in North America, birch barks mostly in the northeastern part, eastern Canada, northeastern United States, all the way to Minnesota. And then the dugouts tended to be west of the Mississippi River, but mostly known in the Pacific Northwest. And then we move from the basic two types of canoes into what they were used for over the years. And we start with the voyageurs and the fur trading era. And then we move through the boats moving out of a working boat sort of circumstance into more of a pleasure craft, a recreational craft, as it were, and how that changes the materials the boats are made out of. But of course, the basic form of the boat never changes, which is one of the great things about canoes. And then we talk about various uses through the 20th century, and then really the revolution after World War II in synthetic materials. Then you've got aluminum boats, you've got fiberglass boats, eventually you get to Kevlar, Royal X, and now carbon fiber and so on. So, and then at the end of the book, we talk a lot about how the canoes really were revived in the 1960s as part of the environmental movement and the human-powered movement of that period, and then some of the great canoe literature in American letters. And there's a lot of it. A lot of great writers have written about canoes over the years.
One of the things you mentioned a number of times, and you touched on it there, and it may be a revelation to readers, but the form of the canoe has basically stayed the same over thousands of years. At what point did you reach that realization, or was it always there for you?
One of the main points that we'd like people to take away from this book is that, just what you mentioned, Jim, is that let's say, for example, an early woodland Indian, you know, from 5,000 years ago or 6,000 years ago were to suddenly appear today. If I showed him a silhouette of a canoe, he would know what it was used for, and how to drive it. And that basic form has not changed. And one of our takeaway points is that very fact that sometimes the materials to construct it have changed and maybe tweaked around the edges a little bit. But there was only two pieces of technology in North America that remain unchanged with European settlement. One is the canoe. And I always ask people if they could think of what the second one was. And people kind of guess around it, but never quite do. And the second one is the snowshoe. No amount of European tinkering with either of those forms improved it at all.
You've got some really attractive photos in the book, and you got to see and hopefully paddle some really gorgeous canoes. And I wonder, you know, from that collection, do you have a favorite, you know, that you'd like to covet?
Wow, that's a great question, Jim. I love paddling the birch bark canoes. It's such a different experience. And it's probably not necessarily the physical experience of it, although I think there are some physical differences in how a birch bark canoe handles as opposed to a non-birch bark canoe. For one thing, I was reminded in my time in a birch bark canoe why so many authors referred to a birch bark canoe as a leaf on the water. They're very lightweight. It takes very little effort, really, to propel them forward. And at least in my experience, they've been very quick. I like all of them. Anytime you can get on a water is a good time.
That's author Mark Neusel on this edition of Paddle Minnesota on Northern Community Radio. You've included some biographies in the book of key figures, both historical and contemporary, in the canoe world. Tell us about some of those explorers and artists and builders and writers and activists that you feel are influential.
It's really a book about people as much as it is about boats. Because, of course, people build the boats and people steer the boats and people occasionally have accidents in the boats. One of the ones I thought was most poignant to me, and it really sticks in my mind, is a particular voyageur named Mongle, M-O-N-G-L-E, out of Montreal, who worked in the western part of Canada in the late 18th, early 19th century. And, you know, Jim, one of the things about the voyageurs, we really know very little about them. And one of the reasons we know very little about them is because there's no written record left by the voyageurs because most of them didn't know how to write. And so it wasn't as if they all crafted autobiographies when they were done. And in fact, many of them didn't make it to a very ripe old age anyway. But in this particular case, this voyageur had dictated a letter to a prefect at one of the posts. And the letter was to his wife back in Montreal. And it was kind of a standard, I miss you, honey. I haven't been home in 3 years. I hope that, you know, you still get the paychecks and that you've, you know, paid the bills and the dog is okay and all that stuff. Unfortunately, in between the time he dictated the letter and the time his wife received the letter, he drowned in an accident on the Columbia River. The only reason that his letter survived today is because his wife took the letter to the Hudson's Bay Company as proof of his employment, because she wanted his back pay. And so she went into Montreal to the company headquarters and said, you know, my husband was in your employ and he has passed away in your employ and you owe me this money. And they did, and they paid her, and they kept the letter in their files. Otherwise, we would have never known about this fellow's life or his particular circumstance, but it's the only letter that we could find in any of the archives that was from an actual voyageur, in his words, to his wife.
Northern Minnesota canoe country would seem to have more in common with Canada than perhaps further south.
The canoe is really a Canadian icon. You'd be hard-pressed to think of an artifact that represented Canada better than a canoe. The previous prime minister, Pierre Trudeau, was, you know, a colorful character for many years in Canada and the Canadian scene, political scene, cultural scene. And a poignant moment in the book for us was at his funeral, where as his casket lay in state at the Capitol, a single canoe paddle leaned against it.
The other era that you addressed was the what you called the human-powered recreation movement. And I guess along with that is the environmental movement that's rolled into that. Tell us a bit about the role of the canoe in that movement.
In the 1960s, as environmental awareness starts to grow around the United States and North America and elsewhere. And in many cases, this awareness is piggybacked on a series of dramatic events. So we mentioned dramatic events like the photograph of the Earth from the moon, for example, or the Cuyahoga River fire in Cleveland, Ohio, the Santa Barbara oil spill, Earth Day itself, all part of that process by which environmental awareness is being raised. And so what we see in the 1960s is a kind of a revival of outdoor activities that don't require anything but human propulsion. All these kinds of outdoor activities that had been, I don't want to say forgotten, maybe downplayed a little bit after World War II, come back in quite large numbers and a lot of people enjoying them. And canoeing is a part of that. You didn't have to have a whole lot of money to be able to buy a canoe.
To no surprise, quite a few Minnesotans are included in this book. Tell us about some of them and their contributions to the ongoing history of the canoe.
Well, you know, there's so many ways that Minnesota has connections to canoes and canoeing over the years. There have been a number of great canoe builders in Minnesota, for example. And I think of birch bark builders, the Ojibways, of course. One could argue built the best birch bark canoes. It's certainly among the most beautiful boats you'll ever see. You had wooden canvas builders in Minnesota as well. They, of course, have come and gone and mostly gone, but there's guys like Alex Combe at Stewart River and Eric Simula is building birch bark boats still. You've got Jeannie Borquin and Ely building wooden canvas canoes. Of course, any discussion of canoeing in Minnesota probably needs to mention Winona Canoes and Mike Chikanowski in Winona, Minnesota, to this day the world leader in Kevlar canoe sales. He's kind of the last of the owner-operators of the canoe companies.
A few contemporary contributors to the world of canoeing, Dave and Amy Freeman. Tell me about their contribution.
They essentially paddled and portaged from northern Minnesota to Washington, D.C. in a canoe that was signed by a number of people as part of an awareness campaign to bring awareness to the Boundary Waters canoe area, the Quetico area, and the mining issues surrounding it. One of the things that the Freemans have been able to sort of point out to us is that the canoe can sometimes be thought of even as a political statement, much in the same way that perhaps 80 years ago, maybe a guitar could have been a political statement. You know, the Freemans just concluded a whole year in the Boundary Waters as part of their work. It's really an unusual and maybe, I don't want to say uniquely Minnesotan, but it certainly is Minnesotan, isn't it?
It really is. For one thing, there are few places like the Boundary Waters that exist that you could go and spend a year and visit 500 lakes, I think.
Makes my shoulders sore just thinking about it, Jim.
Thanks for talking with me today. You've compiled a really an attractive book, some nice writing and some gorgeous pictures. It is a great contribution.
It's been a real pleasure, Jim, to be on a community radio. It's so important, and I'm really grateful that you guys are carrying this on. Thank you.